This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Cincinnati is home to more than 25,000 refugees from countries such as Bhutan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Syria, Burma, Somalia, Eritrea, Iraq, Burundi, Sudan. In addition, 60,000 Hispanic immigrants and refugees also live here. All these families face daunting legal path that is a constant worry for the adults and is reflected in the lives of the children in our schools. The Immigrant and Refugee Law Center, the IRLC, was created to provide affordable legal services to these immigrants and refugees through the community learning centers that operate in the Cincinnati Public Schools. To discuss the work of the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center, I am joined today by the president of the board of the IRLC, Darlene Kamine. Ms. Kamine is an attorney herself, is well known for her groundbreaking work leading the effort to develop community learning centers, a concept that is not only here in Cincinnati, but has spread nationally. Also, the executive director of the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center, an attorney, Julie LeMaster, and the director of Roberts Academy Welcome Center, Antonio Fernandez. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here today. Antonio, let's start out with you.
Okay.
Roberts Academy in Price Hill is not your typical Cincinnati Public School, and certainly not, if we're talking about who goes there, the demographics and all of that, and not certainly not your typical school in the region getting out in the suburban areas. So tell us a little bit about Roberts and what kind of school it is, who the children are, and what do they bring every day to that school?
Well, it's a very unique place, definitely. We have a population of 820 students, and I mean, every day we see something new, something different, just because of the diversity. And I always say that it represents exactly the world we're living in. You see people from countries like you just mentioned, as well as from Venezuela, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico, and that makes it so special. That makes Roberts to be a really special place.
You know, and people might think language would at least tie people from Latin America together, from Mexico and Latin America together. But a lot of those students may speak, in fact, indigenous languages rather than Spanish as their first language.
You're right. Yeah. A lot of our students, Spanish is their second or third language. We have, in some cases, even the fifth language. So they mainly speak Mam, Quiche, and there's, I mean.
And most of us Americans, at least let me put it this way, I am too typical of a lot of Americans. I speak one language, sort of, and struggle with everything else. So it's amazing how many languages these families and the children talk when they've already arrived
it
here.
Is, yeah.
Darlene, this is a new initiative, really got opened in February, but how does it sort of fit into the community learning center model, and how does it sort of grow out of that model?
Mm-hmm. Well, community learning centers are intended to be one-stop shop centers of the community for children and families with all of the partnerships that create the conditions that are necessary for learning to support everything that a child needs to be able to just concentrate on being a student. And in Roberts, for example, we have a comprehensive health center on site because it's so difficult to be able to get to a clinic, especially if you're working a couple of jobs. We have access to dental and vision care, mental health services, wonderful enrichment programming beyond the school day. But we had a lot of families who were coming to the school who didn't speak English, and so we added the director of the Welcome Center that Antonio referenced, who is there to be able to be a one-stop shop within a one-stop shop so that he's really be able to help families who are new to the community. So this is a different level. It's almost like a resettlement organization for families who are first coming to Cincinnati. And through his work, we discovered that there are many things that we were unable to kind of get to because the destabilization of immigration status and all of the related legal issues were a barrier to being able to really concentrate on things like English classes and housing and engaging with your child's homework, for example, when you're worried about whether or not somebody in your family is going to be picked up on the way to the drugstore getting medicine for the child and suddenly disappears and is on their way to being deported, often without merit. So about 3 years ago, we really started to look around for some kind of partner that would provide legal services for our families. And the few lawyers that are doing this work for this kind of population, Catholic Charities and Legal Aid, were swamped. And so it was very, very – plus the issues of transportation to be able to get there. So we just got on the road like we do with all of the other partnerships we try to develop to see who could be there. There wasn't anyone there. And then in July, I had the opportunity to come together with a fellow Brandeis alum. And over coffee, this came to be in July, this just a few months ago.
Okay. So, Julie LeMaster, you're the fellow Brandeis
yes, <that's me.
laughs> alum. And I've known Darlene long enough to know that this idea has probably been kicking around in some form for a long time. So, you come at this from a background of doing a lot of work in social justice in a lot of different – and I didn't want to get into all of those details. But – when you had lunch with Darlene, was this the idea that you were going to talk about? Did you already see it, or was it something that sort of perked up?
Well, I think it surprised both of us. We hadn't seen each other in about 10 years. We were catching up. I had recently moved back to town after having lived in D.C. for years, doing international work, especially in conflict-affected countries. So working with a lot of refugees and refugee issues. And I spent many years before that also working with immigration and human trafficking and similar issues. So when I came back to town, I wasn't following a job. It was for personal reasons. And I continued to do D.C.-based consulting work. And I'd been doing some teaching. But I was thinking, as I thought more about what I would want to do more locally, I wanted to work with immigrants and refugees again, because, like I said, that's kind of the roots of my career, but also brings together, brings back home the international work that I've been doing with conflict-affected countries. So I think at the beginning of our conversation, Darlene asked me what I wanted to do now that I was back home. And I said, I'd love to work with immigrants and refugees. And she said, well, let me tell you what I have been doing the past 10 years. And she told me about the community learning centers and how they developed and, this really critical need they've been seeing, especially in their centers with large immigrant and refugee populations, the need that families have for these legal services. And she told me, as she was describing, about how she'd been trying to find a way to get these services into
the
schools.
So what are some of the legal services that you're actually trying to provide here?
So mostly immigration-related services, helping people to navigate our very complex legal system. There are different kinds of cases we work with. We're working with a lot of asylum seekers, especially moms and children who come from a lot of the countries that Antonio mentioned, like Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, who are fleeing a lot of violence, whether it be domestic violence, family violence, gang violence.
And to gain refugee status, what do they have to convince the authorities of?
So they have to prove that they have what we call well-founded fear of persecution in their home country, so that they've been persecuted based on race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or being a member of a particular social group, which many women in these countries are considered. And they also look at the systems in these countries. Unfortunately, they don't have protection. It's not like here where we have our police and our law enforcement, our judicial system that actually works to protect people. They have to show that they've had to really leave these situations. We also work with people who are refugees, which means that they've gone through this process before they've come to the country. So the countries you initially mentioned, families from Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Iraq, those kinds of countries where they've had to flee conflict and gone through what is usually about a two-year process before they come to this country.
They've been vetted already.
Exactly. But we help them with the next steps. You know, as they establish their life here in this country, they need to then apply for their green cards for permanent residency and ultimately for citizenship. And there are a lot of other questions to come up because, you know, not only are they in a new country, these are completely new systems for them.
And they don't speak the language.
Yes. Often they don't speak the language. So it's
And Antonio, at Roberts, to what extent do you see unaccompanied minors in the student population, people who, young people who have come across the border without a parent and end up here? Is that something that is happening here in Cincinnati, or is that happening in other places and we're a little too far inland for that to reach us?
No, it is actually happening here in Cincinnati. We see mainly, I will say, 15, 16, 17-year-old students. Sometimes they're minors, like they're between 0 to 5 years old, and they come with a family member, which is not mom or dad. And I will say, I don't have an exact number.
Right. I'm not looking for the number. I'm just...
It is something that we see pretty often.
And Julia, is that working with children who are unaccompanied minors, is that a whole nother status that has to be clarified, or are they just in limbo?
Yes. No. There's a couple of routes that children can go. They also can be asylum seekers, but there's also what's called a special immigrant juvenile status, which is where, you know, if they can't be with one or both of their parents due to some kind of neglect, abuse, or abandonment, or if it's not in their best interest to return to their country, so one or both of their parents are back home and they've had to escape, there's a special process that they can go through to then have status and residency and ultimately citizenship here in the U.S.
So, Darlene, you have the center uses contributed services from lawyers, and the whole model of the Community Learning Center, I think there is a worry out there among some people that somehow money that is tax levy money meant to support the schools is going to be diverted into this kind of activity, or if people understood the Community Learning Centers, and it could be into medical services or dental services or vision services, all sorts of things. So what's the impact financially on the schools for any program coming out of community learning centers?
The short answer is none. The whole concept of community learning centers is that we have taxpayer-funded buildings, indeed, that are very often underutilized, let's say extended day during the summer. And again, to be able to maximize the learning of children, so many other things are necessary in order for us all as a community to see the success that we would like for our schools. So about 20 years ago, Cincinnati Public really became the leader in the nation for this model where that space would be utilized by partnerships. It's a hub of partnerships, and each partner is in that building with their own financial model to be self-sustaining long-term. So, for example, with regard to medical services, just as if they had a space down the street where they were renting some kind of clinic area, they are able to use space within the school, and they bill third party for insurance, either Medicaid or private insurance, and their business model also includes those who don't have insurance. So they have enough revenue in their models to be able to be sure that they can fulfill the promise to the community learning center, to the school, and to the community that they will see everyone in the school regardless of their ability to pay. They also serve the community. So it's not just the children in the school building, because the buildings belong to us as a city. And so families who might go to charter school or parochial school or kids that aren't enrolled in school yet also have the ability to be able to access this. But it not only means that there's no impact on the school budget or on the taxpayers, but it also means that they can function on a long-term basis. And one other quick point is that it is for donors who are supporting, for example, with the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center, our expenses for this operation are donated. They are donors and some foundations that are providing funding to support this operation because we are not charging the clients that are coming. But what is a wonderful return on investment is really that it can be – there's no overhead because they're not being charged rent. And so your donor dollar is going directly – to program, directly to impact the people you intend to impact and not to fix a furnace or a roof.
Julie, I'd like to just explore a couple of technical things. One is not every lawyer out there knows anything about immigration law. And a lot of the lawyers who might know about immigration law, they're dealing with Procter & Gamble and GE with H-1B visas. Mm-hmm. And that's the other end of this whole process. Also controversial at this point, but that's another story. So where do you find the lawyers who are going to donate the time and be effective for the people that they're serving?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are kind of a few ways that we're working to provide the services. So there, like you said, there are a lot of lawyers out there that do maybe immigration, but it's business immigration, that have interest in learning this kind of work. There are lawyers that might do completely different kinds of law, but really, you know, people are really looking for ways to get involved. There are several different types of cases that we can, train attorneys on or even non-attorneys to work on pieces of cases to then be able to do volunteer work with us. Darlene's also helping to refer, other types of issues that come up within the community, family issues, maybe housing or employment that we might not provide directly, but we'd hope to be able to refer to other volunteer attorneys. And we're also working with a lot of students. So we have students from the University of Cincinnati College of Law and other schools that we're working with that really, again, you know, really, really want to get involved in these areas. And I'm also an adjunct faculty at UC, and I love working with the students. So that's another great resource for us.
A technical question. Mm-hmm. A lot of times families who are in this legal process, when they have a hearing, where do they have to go for those
yes.
hearings? It's a very practical thing I'm aware of because of some immigrants that I know.
Right.
But it's a real difficulty.
Yes, it is very difficult. Years ago when I was in law school, there was actually an immigration court here in Cincinnati, so I got to go there. However, the immigration court for people living in Ohio is in Cleveland. So that's quite a trek. People living, for instance, in Kentucky, northern Kentucky, we're going to Memphis. They've recently opened an immigration court in Louisville, but it's very inconvenient, obviously. And then we're, dealing with a lot of people who have, the language and transportation issues. So
it's difficult
on all of us.
Yeah. So you have to find people who are able to take people
right.
To Cleveland or mm-hmm. Louisville or Memphis mm-hmm. or whatever. And that's time, it's expense, it's
right.
all sorts of things. It's another sort of volunteer part of this, though, that somebody could
exactly,
be involved with.
Yes.
Anthony, what's the broader role of the Welcome Center? And I'm wondering about what services ESL, English as a Second Language, or mm-hmm. what other services that you're trying to make sure that the families have access to?
We pretty much try to find everything that is needed. Even if we don't have the service, we look for it, and we try to link the families to the right organization or group that can help them. But we do have Spanish classes, English classes, cooking classes. We have a program called Learning Together for children from 0 to 5 years old. Housing, employment. The list is never-ending, and sometimes, We have tried things that we tried once and we're like, I don't think this is going to work. but we try to offer every single service or every single need. We try to accommodate to the need.
You know, one of the interesting things is that with the language, my experience is that children will pick it up a lot faster than their parents.
For sure.
And then they become the people who can go with the parents, right, and be the interpreters,
yes,
to very formal meetings. And it's really interesting to watch how all that happens. Julie, could you just give me a concrete case that says, that describes sort of the core of what the work is here that you're performing? Without using a name, but a real case.
Sure. Just trying to think which one to use. There are so many stories that we've told. It's hard to think which one to choose. So I think one of them that really hit me was, and I think shows the special and unique model that we have working through the schools, is a couple months ago, the principal came in with a mom who was very distraught, and they knocked on my door with Antonio. And she had a partner who had been detained by ICE, so it was a very by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, so it was a very serious situation. And so we talked about the legal piece, and then she wanted to tell her son, who's in sixth grade at Roberts, what was happening. But she wanted to do it there at the school. And I thought, well, you know, we'll have our conversation about the legal parts, and then she'll go back with Principal Beauchamp, and they'll talk to her son. And so when I opened the door and I said, we're finished, everybody piled into my office. And I said, okay, wow, I guess this is happening here. And it was Antonio and the principal and somebody from the health center who spends a lot of time with the child, and mom and the kid. And we sat there and, you know, she told him what was happening. And it was, you know, heart-wrenching for us. But at the same time, just amazing to see this support system that we have there and we can provide. And as Antonio said, you know, all the different services, you know, we're getting together through Women Helping Women. We'll be providing groups for women who've been through trauma. So just being able to work with the kids and work with the families and follow them through all of this is really amazing.
Well, I want to thank Antonio Fernandez, Julie LeMaster, and Darlene Kamine, not only for being here today, but for the work you're doing.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.